on to our second case for the morning and last one for the day, 11-AP-2868-CR, State v. Clayton W. Williams. Arguing on behalf of the state is Assistant Attorney General Moore, S.J. Whalen.
May it please the Court, this case is about legislative intent. When it enacted with Stat 346-65-2AM6, which I'd like to call 2AM6, did the legislature intend to impose a mandatory minimum 3-year term of confinement on seventh-time OWI offenders? Two members of the Court of Appeals held that the statute does not impose that requirement. Moreover, they concluded that the statute is clear and unambiguous on this point. It is hard to see how the majority could conclude that this provision unambiguously does not impose a mandatory minimum.
I thought it was the state's position at one of the other courts that this was not ambiguous.
Well, that is still my own personal interpretation of the statute. However, as I said in the reply brief, we are really obligated to try to make the strongest arguments we can. And when both the circuit court judge and dissenting Judge Blanchard, which saw things my way in terms of saying that a mandatory minimum is intended by the legislature, but they saw the statute as ambiguous, I just felt like I had to bow to what seemed to be the great weight of opinion, even though I still see the meaning as plain. But
I'm wondering if you're correct in talking about legislative intent. Mm-hmm. General view is you got 132 people, and to talk about legislative intent, you have no idea what 132 people intended. Mm-hmm. You don't even know what the majority of them intended. And then what you have to do is you have to look at the text, right?
That's where you have to start.
That's right. And then look at the context, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you can look at the statutory history, which is not extrinsic. And you don't look at the legislative history unless it's ambiguous.
Correct.
Right?
Correct.
Okay. So are you going to start with the text?
Yes. I'm not sure if you want me to start with the text to say why my original position is that the meaning is plain, or if you want me to start with the text to get me to the point of saying it's ambiguous and that's why we look at legislative history.
I want you to do what the state's position is.
Well, the position, well, they are sort of interrelated. The text of the statute refers to a bifurcated sentence. The state concludes that the imposition of a bifurcated sentence is therefore assumed, and that's why I personally felt that the meaning was plain. However, I understand that that meaning is not shared by everyone, including Judge Blanchard. However, it is hard to see how one could read the bifurcated sentence language and conclude that a bifurcated sentence is unambiguously not required. That's where I feel that even if I'm wrong about plain meaning, it's the conclusion that that language is unambiguous in the other direction just seems clearly wrong. I can't understand why the statute would refer to a bifurcated sentence if it were not obviously required. And for that reason, the statute is ambiguous.
Oh, it could say if you don't give probation and you're going to put somebody in prison, then you got to have 3 years. That's what the statute can be read
well,
to say.
When you look at the whole sentencing scheme as a whole, the statutory intent becomes even more ambiguous. As Judge Blanchard called it, the statute has a puzzling or odd feature conceived by the majority, because under their reading, a seventh plus of OWI offender can be sentenced in the following ways. He can get probation with or without jail time, and jail time being capped at a year, or he may receive a bifurcated sentence with a confinement term of between 3 and 5 years. He may not be confined for 1.5 years, 2 years, or 2.5 years. This odd feature forces the question, did the legislature intend to give the sentencing courts such an odd menu of choices?
And no, the judges believe, many judges believe, I heard this at numerous educational sessions and read it in the record, that if you're going to send them somebody to prison, you got to do it for a long time because they will not get any treatment for addiction until they've been there 2 to 3 years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So maybe that's what the legislature has in mind.
Well, I certainly know that just from reading hundreds of transcripts over the years that judges do sometimes have what is a relatively lengthy confinement time for these treatment reasons. However, I have certainly seen judges confine someone for 2 years because they say, and near the end of that time, you'll get treatment. I might not have given you 2 years, but I want you to get that treatment. The idea that you need a certain prison time to get treatment does not answer the question why a circuit judge is unable to sentence someone to 1.5, 2, or 2.5 years, and everything else in between.
Well, maybe the legislature is using the same reasoning and doesn't state it. I have another question. And prior to 7, can the court give probation?
Yes.
Does the court have to give jail time?
At every step from second to sixth offense, the court has to give a certain minimum amount of jail time.
Okay.
And this is another reason, I think, without going to, well, not, this is not quite a reason, but without going to legislative history, we should interpret the statute as imposing these minimum 3 years.
What's the statutory language in second to sixth that says minimum jail time?
Excuse me?
What's the statutory language?
Oh, okay. In second to sixth. Right.
That requires minimum jail time.
Okay. So we're looking at 346.65.2a.m. And I guess I should look at my brief instead. And subsection 2 says that a person guilty of a second offense shall be imprisoned for not less than 5 days nor more than 6 months. Subsection 3, third offense, not less than 45 days nor more than 1 year. Fourth offense, not less than 60 nor more than 1 year. Fourth offense, there are two where one is within 5 years prior to the current offense, shall be imprisoned for not less than 6 months. Fifth or sixth offense shall be imprisoned for not less than 6 months. And the way the probation statute works, as long as the mandatory minimum jail time is less than 1 year, you can get probation as long as you get that jail sentence.
There's one for 1 year. How long can you keep them in jail?
Well, for whatever the statute says. I don't understand. What was the question?
How long in jail?
How long can you keep them in jail under a probation?
Well, depending on how many prior offenses, each of those subsections tell you how many days in jail. Most of them have a minimum and a maximum.
Maximum is what?
Well, in each one, it's different. 6 months, 1 year.
1 year. Can you keep them in jail for 1 year?
On probation.
On probation.
I'm sorry, what? I'm sorry.
And you keep them in jail for 1 year on probation?
Yes.
Okay.
Counsel, if I can direct you back to where you started in all of this, I'm a little bit concerned about the approach that you want to get to the legislative history, mm-hmm. that you can only do so by a finding of ambiguity.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure you're aware of the Teschendorf case. Teschendorf says, no, there's other ways you can get to legislative mm-hmm. history. If you think the law is clear, the statute is clear mm-hmm. and unambiguous, you can still go to legislative history to support the interpretation you're making. Is that not our law?
Well, I think, and maybe I should have looked at all the cases and figured out which was most recent, occurs to me. But my impression, I'm sorry.
Teschendorf is 2 years after Kalal.
Okay.
So it seems to me that you have to read Kalal in the light of Teschendorf.
Okay. I guess I feel that my impression has been that the published decisions, also looking at the Court of Appeals, have been kind of inconsistent about, and I could be wrong, and, you know, if I had maybe charted the course cases, I would have found that it isn't inconsistent. But my impression was that the use of legislative history, whether or not you had to get to ambiguity first, was inconsistent, and that the weight of authority is that you had to get to ambiguity first and that you'd be criticized if you didn't get to ambiguity first. But certainly I know there are cases, and I'm not familiar with the one you're referring to, that say, well, we can also look at legislative history to support our interpretation. Now, there's another thing even before getting to ambiguity, I think, or before getting to extrinsic sources, legislative history, that something different from legislative history is statutory history, where we don't have to go see what the LRB says. We just look at the history of the amendments to the statute. And I think if you look at the pre-Act 100 penalties and the penalties as created by Act 100, what you see is a rationalization of the law over the years, as from which I infer a legislative intent to have a consistent, graduated penalty regime, and one that is more rational than, frankly, it was prior to Act 100, when it was, frankly, absurd, and not sure how it got to that, but that's the way it was.
The legislature is held to a rational basis standard under equal protection. But the legislature isn't held to a standard that we really have to agree with them, or we really think that they're using good common sense or a rational in a, mm-hmm. in a non-legal sense. So it makes common sense to say, hey, you start with one offense, you treat it lightly, you get up to the 10th offense, you know, you ought to treat it heavily. You're obviously not getting to this guy, and you ought to do something about mm-hmm. it. And maybe that's good common sense. But the legislature doesn't have to do that. Mm-hmm. It may be good common sense for a lot of people to say, hey, what you have to do is have that first drunk driving felony, not a civil offense. And a lot of states do have it as a criminal offense. Mm-hmm. I think Wisconsin may be in the minority on that. So the legislature can say, hey, maybe prison doesn't work on the 7th. We've already found out that all these mandatory minimums in jail are not working with this guy, and maybe the judge has to do something different, which might be probation with different kinds of conditions, not prison. So I'm not so sure. I think that your argument on graduated offenses, a graduated punishment, makes sense, but doesn't necessarily mean that's what the legislature wanted, because the legislature knew how to do it. They were amending the same statute. They were adding a provision in here for 7th or and further, and all they had to do was look above and see how you do it. If you wanted to do it that way. And they didn't. So don't you have to assume they wanted something else?
Well, there's a lot in...
You have other statutes that do minimum mandatory, and this does not fit any of them, right? This
right.
is unique.
Right. Yeah, so there's a lot in there, so forgive me if I don't answer all of the implicit questions. Though some of those are already addressed in the briefs, one thing, the question about the using different language throughout sub 2AM, and that only sub 6 and sub 7, which is 7 plus and 10 plus, use the bifurcated sentence language, and why didn't the legislature use that same language in sub 6 and sub 7, and I explain those somewhat clumsily, I think, on pages 17 to 18 of the opening brief, that and also Judge Blanchard addressed this, too, that there are different groups of offenses, really. The subsection 2 to 4 punish misdemeanors. There's no availability for bifurcated sentencing for misdemeanors, so you wouldn't use that language. Subsections 4, M, and 5 are felonies, but the less serious felonies, and those provisions are written in a way to give a lot of different sentencing options. So, you know, they're the intermediate offenses. They get more sentencing options, including probation, which is implicit because of it's less jail time, straight jail time, probation with or without jail, or a bifurcated sentence if the defendant is sentenced in to the Wisconsin state prisons. So because it's a Class H felony, they could be sentenced to Wisconsin state prisons, and then under 97301, you have to have a bifurcated sentence. But the sentencing court is not being obligated to apply that kind of sentence. With those felonies, the sentencing court has the most flexibility other than the requirement that it impose at least a minimum jail time. Then when you get to the most serious felonies, the legislature puts in the bifurcated sentencing language, which is then making that different, most serious requirement for the most serious offenses. The question about if, in short, can't the legislature be irrational, and we have to accept that, that is the way you would describe, and I think I really just did, the pre-Act 100 law. Under the pre-Act 100 law, I think it was second and third time offenders were not allowed probation. fourth, fifth, and sixth time offenders were allowed probation with minimum jail time, required jail time, and seventh and up could have probation with no jail time. So it was a very rational system, and I am, and that's why, even though when I first got this case, I thought that it seemed absurd, I looked at the old law and said, well, that was more absurd, so I can't really say that the Court of Appeals majority is wrong here because its interpretation is absurd. But in terms of legislative intent...
It follows prior statutes.
I'm sorry, what?
Because it follows prior statutes.
Yes. Yeah. But I think that it seems clear in the legislative history and just in the flow of history, so to speak, that the legislature was...
And we have to make that history.
That the legislature is trying to make it more rational. And I just want to point out... I've got it in my brief, but just to highlight what I think is the single most important piece of legislative history is on page 11, and it's the LRB analysis that says the substitute amendment, which was an amendment to the main statute, requires a person who commits a seventh and up OWI related offense to serve a minimum period of confinement of 3 years and requires a person who commits a 10th and up offense to serve a minimum period of confinement of 4 years under a bifurcated sentence.
Counsel, I want to get back to, I think, what this case focuses on essentially, and that is the words of the statute and how that interplays with Kalal. Kalal okay. has been discussed often.
And I always feel sorry for Ralph Kalal, I have to say, every time.
But, well, one of you're talking about...
All of us do.
Talking about legislative history. And of Kalal, of course, in paragraph 51 says, you know, even if it says that when you find that it is unambiguous, you can still resort to legislative history. Legislative history is sometimes consulted to confirm or verify a plain meaning interpretation. So that's in Kalal.
Okay.
But also in Kalal, you started out this way in your argument. You started out, and I'm paraphrasing, in my heart of hearts, I think that this is plain.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is unambiguous. And that's what I believe. But I see two esteemed judges, Judge Rice and Judge Blanchard, and certainly they're reasonable people. And I've got two esteemed and reasonable people saying otherwise. So I'll switch in part, because then, of course, that allows me to get into lots of stuff on page 11 of your brief and the LRB and all that sort of stuff. But let's take a look at what Kalal says. Kalal says, I don't care if reasonable people disagree. That's not the test. The test is whether or not they should disagree. That's paragraph 47
mm-hmm.
of Kalal.
Okay.
And in your heart of hearts, if you think it is plain and unambiguous, that's what you really believe, do you think should they be finding ambiguity under this statute? They do. They're reasonable, but that's not
mm-hmm.
the question.
Mm-hmm.
Should they? If you're in a heart of hearts,
well,
you believe
in my heart of hearts. I think that I would be delighted if your conclusion here is to say that the language is unambiguous. There is no reason to talk about a bifurcated sentence unless a bifurcated sentence is required.
That's not stated in the text.
It's implicit. I mean, it's plain. I feel that meaning is is plain, you know, and maybe then we start to get finicky, well, what do you mean by plain meaning? Because my plain meaning is a meaning that I'm inferring from the plain text. It's not, it doesn't explicitly say you have to impose a bifurcated sentence. I think that if you're talking about how long part of the bifurcated sentence is supposed to be, then implicitly you have required a bifurcated sentence. And I have to say, I don't know why it wasn't explicitly imposed when the legislative intent, given the LRB passage quoted on page 11, was clearly that it should be imposed. And the reason I just wanted to say why that's the most important piece of legislative history is that that's what the legislature had when it adopted this provision, and it adopted the provision word for word as the LRB drafted it. And so I think it is reasonable to assume that the legislature adopted this language word for word if they didn't agree word for word with the LRB's explanation of the language.
But, you know, the LRB's explanation of the language never says that it is required or mandated that there be a bifurcated sentence. The LRB says the engrossed bill would specify that the confinement portion of a bifurcated sentence must not be less than 3 years.
What page are you on?
Drafting file for 2009, WIS Act 100. Committee's report, 2009, Senate Bill 66.
Okay.
So you've got
what I was referring to, this is also
okay.
Difficult.
LRB's analysis says requires a person who commits a 7th, 8th, or 9th OWI to serve a minimum period of confinement of 3 years in prison. That's what you're looking at.
That's what I'm looking
and
at.
And I'm telling you that that's their analysis, but that their analysis does not equate with the statutory language. And if there's an LFB memo mm-hmm. to legislators, and it's a committee report, that uses the same language as the statute. So what you have is conflicting legislative history.
I disagree with that. I think that the LRB language, which I insist is the most important piece because that's what the legislature looked at next to the Senate bill language as they were adopting it, explicitly supports my interpretation. That's page 11. It says the amendment requires the person to serve a minimum period of confinement of 3 years. I think the LFB language is, I believe, the weakest mm-hmm. Arrow in my quiver, because it is similar in that it just really implies. So I believe that the LFB language is the weakest. The other thing is
Then you're relying on my concurrence in Kalal, which said, hey, the legislature sees the LRB stuff. It's right on
right.
the bill. Okay.
Right, right.
You may conclude quickly.
Thank you. Come back, yeah.
All right.
May I ask a question?
Yes, of course. Justice Prosser.
Suppose I said to you the statutes on probation authorize probation for a 7th offense OWI. How would you respond to that using the probation statutes?
The probation statute as it exists now is subject to the case law led by the Duffy case, which say that if there is a mandatory minimum sentence of confinement in a statute, then a sentencing court may not impose probation for that crime. if the probation statute carved out an exception, which it certainly could, and that's something that the legislature could have done when it was amending this statute. It could have said, and by the way, you, sentencing court, you can impose probation for any number of OWI-related offenses. So they could have put that in the probation statute, or they could have put it in the 346-65 penalty statute, but they didn't. And the legislature is presumed to know about Duffy and its, I don't know if it's progeny or just its friends and relations, that there has, that when you've got the mandatory sentencing language, you cannot impose probation.
So, are you assuming that the legislators who voted on Act 100 actually read the LRB analysis and were familiar with the Duffy case?
Well, this might be a Justice Crosby question to answer. But I don't know if we presume that the legislature reads the LRB analysis. I know that until this second, I never doubted that they did. But certainly we presume as a matter of law that they, that the legislature knows what the rest of the law is. We have that. That is a presumption that we have.
Legal fiction.
But it's a legal fiction that applies to how we then interpret the law, because to do anything else would make your jobs much more difficult.
Like saying that everyone is supposed to know the law. Everyone is presumed to know.
Right, which I think is really kind of unreasonable in a lot of situations for the poor folks out there. So anything?
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Stephen D. Winder, Assistant Public Defender representing Clayton Williams.
Thank you. May it please the court, probation has long been available for most felonies, almost all felonies, including the most serious felonies, and including OWI 789. Act 100 did not change that. A number of changes were made to OWI law, but prohibition of probation was not one of them. The only thing that was changed was if a sentencing court elects to send someone to prison or impose a prison sentence, that must include at least 3 years of confinement.
Counselor, could you raise the mic up a little bit so it's a little taller for you? Thank you.
Okay.
That's better. Thank you.
Okay, good, good. The statute doesn't prohibit probation. The statute doesn't require the imposition of a bifurcated sentence. And as has been pointed out already, the legislature certainly knows how to do this when they want to do it. They do it in very direct, clear language. Shall impose, may not place on probation, shall determine a parole eligibility date. Whenever the legislature wants to ensure a particular action by a sentencing court, the legislature puts it in clear, unmistakable language. And I think what the state is asking you to do is to rewrite the statute and add words which impose a mandatory minimum sentence where that language is not there. And this court and most other courts have consistently declined to do that, leaving that to the legislature to fix. And, in fact, I believe the legislature is in the process of amending the statute currently.
Let me ask about 346-65. That statute wasn't written all at the same time, was it? We're really looking at 346-65, 2 AM 6 and 7. Those are the real real heart of this. How probable is it that the legislature authorized somebody who had 14 OWI offenses to get probation?
Well, I think there's a difference between authorizing it and then having a sentencing court impose that disposition. And in general, I would say that when the number of OWIs gets higher, the cases become more complex. There's a longer history, more facts involved. It makes sense that the legislature would want to impose immediate and certain penalties on the lower OWIs, which is evidenced by the fact that they made a fourth within 5 years a felony. But not all, say, seventh or tenth OWIs are the same. And especially with lifetime counting.
How are they different?
I'm sorry?
I mean, not all second and third OWIs are the same either.
That's true.
I mean, you remember what Judge Rice said, that something to the effect that how he would have trouble finding anybody who wouldn't think it was unreasonable not to impose a mandatory minimum sentence for seven offenses.
Yes, and he also said if any candidate had come before him, it would be Mr. Williams. And the reason for that is that...
But he did, his general premise is that most people would say, seven offenses isn't enough. We've tried the 6 months for the five. We've tried the 6 months for the six. We had mandatory minimums lower than that. Seven offenses, how long do we have to go on here?
Well, my response would be, in this case, Mr. Williams amassed his first six before 1998. Then he had a relapse because of some tragic circumstances and got a seventh. And certainly a sentencing judge viewing all the Galleon factors, taking into account all the facts of the case, could find that the sentencing objectives would be met with a lesser penalty or an imposed and stayed penalty or a lengthy term of probation, condition time. Mr. Williams had been successful in bond monitoring for 7 months. Prior to that, he had been sober. And I guess a more extreme example would be if someone had, again, racked up six OWIs in the 90s and then had gone out ill-advisedly and had a beer or two and gotten stopped for broken taillight or something and had a PAC that was illegal. Does that merit a three-year prison sentence? Is that what the legislature intended, a kind of a one-size-fits-all scheme for imposing penalties? We've always entrusted sentencing courts to exercise their discretion. So the fact that probation is authorized certainly doesn't mean that it will be used frequently. And in most cases, I'm sure these defendants do end up going to prison. But there are exceptions, and this might have been one of them.
If I may, there is an unusual factual situation here that kind of tugs at your heartstrings. But your analysis really says it's not just for the seventh offense. It's for the eighth, the ninth, the tenth, the 11th, the 12th, the 13th, the 14th, anything above seven. Yeah, the court, the legislature really expects that the court has the authority to impose probation and no jail time. And no jail time. On the other hand, we cannot permit the circuit court to send someone to prison for a year or two, anything less than three. It's either probation or 3 years. How does that make any sense?
Well, it makes sense in that Like I said, in unusual cases like this, there might be a lesser disposition. But as was alluded to earlier, if a court decides to send someone to prison, that court has concluded, based on the facts of the case, that the person either needs to be incapacitated or treated extensively in the institution, or both. And so the three-year minimum makes sense if a bifurcated sentence is imposed. And again, I guess I keep coming back to this, but you know, the sentencing court must exercise its discretion in each case, and the fact that one party may be asking for probation certainly doesn't mean that the court will impose probation. In practical terms, I think that's going to be that's a rarity. And so I guess that's how I would reconcile that.
Do you know whether there were sentencing guidelines adopted for and used with respect to this offense?
No, I did not look at that. I'm sorry.
Because each district is required to have sentencing guidelines that they adopt. And I'm just curious, because I think if you look at the sentencing guidelines where probation is allowed, it provides for that. I'm curious what the sentencing guidelines looked like for this, you know, the way judges have been interpreting the statute around the state.
Well, I can say that I don't have exact numbers, but I've looked at Court Tracker, and it seems that in 2011 and 2012, which is post Act 100, there were a small number of cases that were disposed of with probation plus a long jail time, generally a very lengthy probation plus long jail time, plus, in some cases, imposed in state sentences. So there are courts.
What, 6 and 7 or 7, 8, and 10?
I'm talking about 7, 8, 9.
Pardon me?
I'm talking about 7, 8, and 9.
Good. Thank you.
There are a small number of cases in which that has been imposed, but I can think of only one that I saw that was probation sentence withheld. Well, probation without additional jail time or other conditions. So judges are interpreting it differently. Some of them are not reading it as requiring a mandatory minimum.
I'm just curious what the guidelines that they use say.
I have not looked at the guidelines.
Well, we didn't have sentencing guidelines in 2011. That's when he was picked up.
Sure we did. OWI.
OWI
guidelines.
OWI for the trial. I'm sorry. The districts had different sentencing standards, and they varied from district to district.
I don't know that the latter part of that is true, but
the judges didn't have to follow them.
No, they're guidelines.
You said there were a relatively small number of cases where probation was given for 7th, 8th, 9th offenses. You have statistics on the number of mandatory minimum sentences that were imposed during the same period.
No, I do not. And I could find those numbers and supply them or provide them to the court later if the court wishes to see those. But no, I'm sorry, I don't have
them. Well, if your interpretation is accepted by the court, is that going to result in a number of motions to change those sentences?
I have a couple of responses to that. One, I looked at, since the Williams decision was issued by the Court of Appeals, and since that time there have only been, and again, it's been a short time, I understand that, but as far as offenses committed since the Williams decision, there have only been two cases in which there was a probationary disposition of some sort with conditions. The other thing I would say is I can't say for certain what the sentencing courts who sent people to prison were relying on. If the sentencing court says, well, you know, I consider probation and this is not one of those cases, you're going in for 4 years, then there's really not much of a basis for a motion there. So I don't know what the numbers would be, but certainly you'd have to meet the requirements for a post-conviction motion to be heard. The requirements being reliance on the mandatory minimum.
I asked you a question earlier, whether 346-65 was written at the same time. And we talked about 2 AM 6 and 7. This one's being affected principally by Act 100. Were any provisions of 346-65 written before Truth in Sentencing?
I have not researched the pre-TIS law on that. Certainly, operating while intoxicated has been prohibited for a long time. I'm not sure what the statutory structure was prior to TIS.
So, for example, guidelines were required before TIS, and that's in 346-65. So 346-65 must have existed in some form.
What I think you'd find, since Truth in Sentencing, I think, came in the 1999 session, if memory serves me correctly, if you look at the statutes before 1999, the 1997-98 statutes, 346-65, you will see a sentencing structure for different offenses. For example, 2E, except as provided in paragraph F, shall be fined not less than $600 nor more than $2,000 and imprisoned for not less than 6 months nor more than 5 years. So the kind of language that is now in some of those preceding sections was already there before Truth in Sentencing. And I just...
Which specific... offense were you referring to just now?
This was for, let's see. I don't have the next page. I think that is probably, let's see. What's probably that? More than four. It was probably five and more or something like that.
Because they weren't broken down by finite categories as they are.
Well, the earlier, that was subsection E. D talks about four. C talks about three, and it's the same kind of sort of more traditional mandatory minimum language already existed before Truth in Sentencing. And I think as a practical matter, when the drafters of the Legislative Reference Bureau are amending a statute, they're not going to revise every single section that really isn't amended just to conform the language to something new. They just don't do that. So that the people who draft in the area of traffic law, for example, are not the same people who draft things like the statute that's cited in the brief, the sexual something. Statute. They're different drafters at different times, different statutes. That's just the way the legislature works.
Yes, I guess my response to that is that the statute must be interpreted in light of the current jurisprudence and the fact that mandatory minimum statutes do exist in other portions of the statutes. And I understand that there's an interplay between the chapter 340 or 345, and the criminal penalties. But in this case, they're really, I can't think of a reason why they wouldn't, if they intended to lock down a certain penalty, why they wouldn't say so, why they wouldn't say so in clear, unmistakable language. The judge shall impose a bifurcated sentence. The judge may not place a person on probation. You were talking about the minimum is pre-TIS. as far as the minimums pre-Act 100, offenses 7, 8, 9, 10 and up were considered felonies, and they were just assigned the penalties that were available for those felonies. So nothing about that, nothing about probation availability was changed by Act 100. And Act 100 simply doesn't say what a mandatory minimum statute says, which is, judge, you have no choice. You shall impose this sentence. So relying on the language of the statute, I don't believe it's a mandatory minimum statute.
Well, I will grant you that you're making a reasonable argument here. I will grant you that. But what you're saying is that I'm not making a reasonable argument, that you cannot interpret the statutes, that there's no ambiguity, there's no room for an interpretation other than yours. Aren't you?
That wasn't my intent. I was explaining my interpretation and my response to your statement, and I'm not saying that it's unreasonable to interpret it that way. I'm just saying that my position is, well, as I just stated and is in the briefs.
Well, you can't really concede that the statutes are ambiguous, can you?
The plain language of the statute is not ambiguous. That's been the argument since the trial court, where trial counsel made that argument, although she didn't make an alternative argument that if it's ambiguous, rule of lenity should apply. I maintained it was unambiguous in the Court of Appeals, and I maintain it's unambiguous now based on the language in the statute. I concede that certainly other judges have disagreed with that. They've found it ambiguous. Judge Blanchard found it ambiguous. And certainly I'm not saying that reasonable people can disagree on that, but my position is that it is unambiguous.
But that's not the definition of ambiguity, whether reasonable people disagree. Reasonable people can disagree. It's whether the two interpretations should be viewed as reasonable. It's really
given
sort of a question of law, given the language of the statute, right? Because otherwise we'd be put in the position of saying, well, the trial court was unreasonable. Court of Appeals interpreted differently. It was totally unreasonable, and the only ones that are reasonable are us. Now, we believe that, but it's not the right thing to say. So the right thing to say is that in light of the text of the statute, this is the reasonable interpretation, and that it is ambiguous or unambiguous. As I always say when I'm talking about statutory interpretation, my favorite line is of a judge saying, I could write it either way. I could write that it's ambiguous. I can write that it's unambiguous. That's right.
And the ambiguity can be in the eye of the beholder.
Exactly. And there's really no definition of it other than that's what you're saying. It is or isn't ambiguous. So, and you're saying it's unambiguous on the text.
Correct. And I would like to another point I'd like to make is that the state's position is that this assumes or implies that a bifurcated sentence will be imposed, but penal statutes that impose a more harsh and immediate consequence should be explained in clear and unmistakable language. Penal statutes shouldn't be extended by implication or by inference. It should be explicit in the statute.
And the legislature can amend it, right?
And the legislature can amend it. The court has regularly declined to add words to amend a statute that may not be working out as the legislature had thought it would. And in fact, the legislature is apparently in the midst of amending the statute now. passed the Assembly a bill that should, that adds the language shall impose a bifurcated sentence, and it's awaiting a vote in the state Senate.
Does, other questions?
Does 2B, M, C, M, and D, M, do those sections factor into your analysis at all?
Say those again.
2B, M, C, M, and D, M. They're the in the counties that offer a reduced minimum for successful completion of probation for, to make it easy, violations that equal two, three, or four.
Those did not factor into my consideration of the statute that we're discussing now. So I apologize for that.
Any other questions? Hearing none, thank you, Mr. Bunder. Ms. Whalen.
Thank you. Mr. Grunder spoke a fair amount about the equities in this case. And as I recall the sentencing transcript, this was a sympathetic defendant. And we could all read that and wonder if he is a person who's better suited to probation than mandatory 3 years in prison. But that's always the question, and many criminal justice critics would argue the problem with mandatory minimums. The legislative purpose underlying any mandatory minimum sentence is to limit the discretion of the sentencing court. Right or wrong, that is the legislative purpose of these kinds of sentencing statutes. And here, it is presumably meant to provide a general deterrent for all drivers in Wisconsin who have already had six convictions as defined by the statute, and say, who might drink and drive regardless of all of their history with their 6 months and their 1 year in jail. And presumably the hope behind mandatories here, once you get to such an egregious number of offenses, is that you're going to really serve the time. And the legislature essentially predetermined. It's like predestination, you know, here it is. We've decided, we have removed that discretion from the sentencing court. So the equities don't matter, as sympathetic as Mr. Williams might be. He, even though his offenses were long ago, he knows he's had the experience six times of getting behind the wheel and getting caught. And that should give him pause. If he's in a vulnerable emotional state, that should give him even greater pause. Gee, you know, I could be vulnerable to doing something stupid. I also wanted to comment in terms of my giving up on my plain meaning argument, it wasn't just the two judges. I'm remembering that I heard anecdotal evidence. I did not look at any statistics from DAs that the DAs and the, or at least the sentencing courts as described by the DAs were having trouble and interpreting the statute inconsistently, and then, you know, that just added to my thinking, oh, I guess I have to say it's ambiguous. Also, Mr. Grunder brought up, again, the rule of lenity implicitly near the end of his argument, but I've already responded to that in the reply brief, and the rule of lenity doesn't come into play until the court has determined, even after viewing legislative history or looking at the statute in context, et cetera, that it's still unclear, and then the rule of lenity applies. And if the court disagrees with me there, then, of course, it could break up the decision about the whole statute and as it applies to Mr. Williams. But I think it's clearly there's no room for the rule of lenity in this case under these circumstances. So that's...
Do you think there's any reason why B, M, C, M, and D, M speak to second, third, or fourth offenses, but not fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, ninth?
I hadn't thought about those provisions at all either, honestly. And it's hard for me, you know, when I'm in the middle of an argument to, like, think about something that is so, I mean, I've read them before, but not carefully. But my understanding, and please correct me if I'm wrong about this, that these are sort of tests. Some counties have, you know, or can be laboratories for this kind of thing. And I just would assume that usually when there's either county laboratories or where the federal government says, well, we'll let the state sort of figure things out, that that can be sort of an exception to the general rule. But I don't really have a cogent answer to your question without reading it and thinking about it. And maybe you would like us to brief that some more.
Thank you, counsel. Unless there's something else asking you, or you have one quick sentence to sum up, the red light's on.
Just that either because the language plainly goes my way or because it's ambiguous, I think you have to read that LRB paragraph quoted on page 11 and conclude that the legislature used the language bifurcated sentence in 2AM 6 and 7 because it intended to force the application of a bifurcated sentence. And it's just puzzling otherwise. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. On behalf of the board, I want to thank both counsel for their briefs and for their argument today on statutory interpretation. I estimate that more than 90% of our cases involve, if not statutory interpretation of some other written document. And that concludes our hearing in 11-18-2868-CR. State versus Clayton W. Williams. The court will meet in closed conference at 1 p.m. We are in recess until our next oral argument later this month.